Today is Monday, August 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. An attack in Afghanistan that started Sunday at a prison is over.
At least 29 were killed. That did not include the five attackers and three prisoners.
Plus, the World Health Organization offers this advice for turning around the pandemic.
Testing, isolating, and treating patients, and tracing, and quarantining their contacts. Do it all.
And we take a look at one iconic program. We'll have those stories and more next. A gun battle between Islamic State fighters and Afghan security forces has ended at a prison in the eastern city of Jalalabad on Monday. Earlier, I spoke with VOA's Aisha Tanzim in Islamabad via WhatsApp for the latest.
Well, the information that we have is that at least 29 were killed, and that did not include the five attackers and three prisoners that the MOD statement said the ISIS killed in the prison. Two of them were Taliban prisoners.
So there are also reports during the fighting that several prisoners escaped. What's the status of that?
So basically, reports said there were almost 1,800 prisoners when the attack commenced, and a lot of them tried to flee. Officials say police have rearrested more than 1,000 of them. Some prisoners died and others are missing, which means they may have escaped. Exactly how many escaped, we don't know yet. But if we go by, a little more than 1,000 rearrested and around 29, some of them were prisoners, we have around a rough figure of 1,100, but then the officials said that some prisoners were in the prison. They never escaped. So we don't know exactly how many are missing.
Now, in the past few weeks, there's been an uptick in violence in Afghanistan with the Taliban. And while this attack was claimed by the Islamic State militant group, has the Taliban issued any statements about this attack?
Yes, they have. They've distanced themselves from this attack. They've said they had nothing to do with it. And this attack started Sunday evening, which was the third day of Eid al-Adha in Afghanistan. Taliban had announced a three-day, three-night ceasefire, so had the Afghan government, in the hopes that in the coming weeks, direct negotiations between Taliban and the Afghan government and other Afghan factions would start. And there is a lot of pressure on the Taliban from international, countries like the U.S., European Union, United Nations, everybody, to keep the level of violence low in order to start the intra-Afghan negotiations. So the Taliban made sure they distanced themselves from this particular attack. Sometime that in 2009, Afghan government declared that ISIS was defeated in Nangarhar. Everybody who watches Afghanistan closely thought that was a premature announcement. Since then, the group has carried out several attacks.
Aisha Tanzim is VOA's Afghanistan and Pakistan bureau chief. I spoke to her in Islamabad. A Johns Hopkins University COVID-19 tracker now counts over 18 million confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus, 10.7 million recoveries, and nearly 690,000 deaths. Speaking today at the World Health Organization headquarters in Geneva, WHO Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus reflected on the 6 months since he declared a public health emergency of international concern.
67% of countries report disruption in family planning and contraception services. More than half of countries reported disruption in antenatal care services, and more than a third of countries reported disruption in childbirth services. On top of the health impact, we have seen the damage COVID-19 has caused socially, economically, and politically.
Tedros acknowledged the tough choices governments face in addressing the pandemic, but added that it was possible to turn things around.
When leaders step up and work intensely with their populations, this disease can be brought under control. We learn every day about this virus, and I'm pleased that the world has made progress in identifying treatments that can help people with the most serious forms of COVID-19 recover. The committee recommended that countries engage in the Access to COVID-19 Tools Act Accelerator, participate in relevant clinical trials, and prepare for safe and effective therapeutics and vaccine introduction. A number of vaccines are now in phase 3 clinical trials, and we all hope to have a number of effective vaccines that can help prevent people from infection. However, there is no silver bullet at the moment, and there might never be. For now, stopping outbreaks comes down to the basics of public health and disease control. Testing, isolating, and treating patients, and tracing and quarantining their contacts. Do it all. Inform, empower, and listen to communities. Do it all.
The Director General also announced that a framework for researching the origin of the novel coronavirus had been achieved and that scientists would be heading to Wuhan, China to begin their investigations. The United States is in a new phase of the novel coronavirus outbreak, with infections extraordinarily widespread in rural areas as well as cities, according to a White House coronavirus expert speaking on news program Sunday. Reuters' Lisa Bernard has that story.
A top U.S. health official on Sunday warned that the country is in a new phase of the novel coronavirus outbreak, with infections, quote, extraordinarily widespread in rural areas as well as big cities. Dr. Deborah Birx, the White House Coronavirus Task Force coordinator, told CNN's State of the Union, quote, what we are seeing today is different from March and April. It is extraordinarily widespread. To everybody who lives in a rural area, you are not immune or protected from this virus. Birx said people living in multi-generational households in areas with outbreaks should wear masks inside the home to protect the elderly or those with underlying conditions. Birx also said the Trump administration has been working on individual reports for each state examining community trends and hospital records. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said on Sunday she does not have confidence in Birx, linking her to disinformation spread by President Trump. Pelosi told ABC's This Week, quote, I think the president has been spreading disinformation about the virus and she is his appointee, so I don't have confidence there, no. Birx, asked on CNN about Pelosi's comment, said she had great respect for the speaker and attributed the criticism to a New York Times article on the White House pandemic response that described Birx as having embraced overly optimistic assessments on the virus. Birx added, quote, I've never been Pollyannish, nor non-scientific or non-data driven. I will stake my 40-year career on those fundamental principles of using data to implement better programs and save lives. The coronavirus has infected 4.6 million people in the U.S. and killed more than 155,000 Americans, according to a Reuters tally.
That was Reuters reporter Lisa Bernhard. The Australian state of Victoria has declared a state of disaster and is introducing the country's toughest ever COVID-19 lockdown measures. The move comes as a further 671 cases and 7 deaths were confirmed Sunday. Phil Mercer reports that Australia has had almost 18,000 coronavirus infections, resulting in more than 200 deaths.
A public health bushfire is how the authorities in Victoria have described the COVID-19 emergency. You can't smell the smoke and you can't see the flames, but this, they've said, was a wicked enemy. A state of disaster has been declared, and Melbourne, a city of 5 million people, is under tough new restrictions, including a nighttime curfew that will last for 6 weeks. After early success in suppressing the coronavirus, Australia has had fewer confirmed infections and deaths than many other countries. But the worsening situation in Victoria has the entire country on edge. On Sunday, 671 new infections were reported. 7 people died. In the Australian context, these numbers are significant and disturbing. Australia's federal treasurer is Josh Frydenberg.
This is devastating that we're heading for these stage four restrictions, that there's curfews imposed, that there's more restrictions on the movement of people throughout the community, of course, more school closures. Nobody wanted to get to this. We feel we're very much in a warlike situation. Every Victorian is on the front line. We can't afford any holes in our defence, so everybody needs to follow these rules. There's only one way out, and that's to stem the tide of new cases.
The Victorian state government says that previous disease control measures were working too slowly. Residents will have to stay within 5 kilometres of their homes, and only one person per household is allowed to go shopping for food each day. Schools and childcare centres will close. Australia's strictest lockdown follows the deadliest week of the pandemic here so far. Health experts believe a surge in COVID-19 cases was exacerbated by a relaxation of earlier restrictions, complacency on social distancing, and sheer bad luck. A state of disaster gives police and emergency services broader powers to enforce restrictions, including the curfew. It is an emergency that constitutes, or is likely to constitute, a significant and widespread danger to life or property in Victoria. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And still to come in today's program...
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.
This is Science in a Minute.
About 66 million years ago, the Cretaceous Tertiary extinction event is said to have destroyed about 75% of the Earth's plant and animal species. The most popular suspected cause of this mass extinction is the Chicxulub impact event, in which a 10-kilometer-wide asteroid smashed into what is now Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. Researchers led by Imperial College London have created new 3D simulations of the asteroid impact event. From these new simulations, the researchers found evidence that suggests the asteroid impacted Earth from the deadliest possible angle of 60 degrees, which boosted the amount of climate-changing gases that were forced from Earth and into the upper atmosphere. These gases are said to have blocked sunlight from reaching Earth, starting a species-killing chain reaction known as a nuclear winter. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. This is World Breastfeeding Week. Now, during normal times, that means hundreds of workshops and speeches and celebrations about the health benefits of breastfeeding for young children and for their mothers. This year, the pandemic has forced the commemoration online, but the value of breastfeeding for infant nutrition and the family budget is still crucial. Early in the pandemic, there was concern among many mothers that COVID-19 could be transmitted through their breast milk, and a tendency to avoid visits to maternal and prenatal clinics for fear of contracting the virus. Now, to find out more about these concerns, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke by Zoom with Toyin Adewale Gabriel with FHI Solutions, an international organization focusing on addressing nutrition and health. She is the advocacy and policy advisor for the group's Alive and Thrive initiative in Nigeria.
Well, as you know, the COVID-19 pandemic situation is unprecedented. At first, there was initially some confusion for mothers in relation to breastfeeding and COVID. Also, there was a significant drop in attendance at clinics and also for immunization because mothers felt that coming to the facility put them at risk of infection. But then a lot of work has been done with new guidance says that once you follow the protocols, wearing of the face mask and also making sure that the hands are washed, it's safe to continue to breastfeed. So gradually, as the restrictions have been eased in Nigeria, there's also been a corresponding increase at the facilities.
So there is no transmission of COVID through breast milk itself?
No, there is no evidence that there's COVID transmission through the breast milk. But breast milk is a baby's first immunization. So it's very important to also ensure that mothers continue to breastfeed their babies.
Tell us again why breast milk is so important.
Breast milk is medicine. It has all the nutrients that The baby needs to keep growing for the first 1,000 days of life. And it's very, very important that mothers and families maximize the benefits of breast milk, especially in this COVID-19 pandemic, to provide the most immunity against disease they can provide for their babies.
Of course, the economic impact of COVID has meant widespread economic dislocation, along with fear of famine.
Well, you know, the National Bureau of Statistics have done some studies on the economic impact of the pandemic on livelihoods. And you can see the inflation since May has been growing month by month. Things are extremely expensive, but breast milk comes cost-free. It's available. And the science is out there that even when the mother does not have enough nutrition for herself, she's still able to provide enough breast milk for her baby. And so the family is free of the cost associated with infant formula, which is very expensive, you know, and it's not advised.
I know that organizers for this year's World Breastfeeding Week have linked environmental awareness with their normal recommendations in favor of breast milk.
Yes, the thematic tone for this year's World Breastfeeding Week is about breast milk in support of the environment. And we do know, you know, the breast milk substitutes from the production to the packaging process to landfills and environmental pollution.
Speaking of infant formula, I'm told there was a significant ramp up in corporate marketing of formula during the days when people were not so sure that babies would not get COVID through breast milk.
That's correct. And there's been a lot of international effort to push back against the aggressive marketing. If you are going to do a donation, it should not be branded. But in this context, because of the panic, a lot of marketing was going on.
Through radio and TV and other media?
Not on the media, but through so-called humanitarian efforts, donations of branded breast milk. You know, so it was time to make a public statement on the need to comply with the code.
Toyin Adewale Gabriel is the advocacy and policy advisor for the FHI Solutions Alive and Thrive Initiative in Nigeria. She was speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips. China's ByteDance has agreed to divest the U.S. operations of TikTok completely in a bid to save a deal with the White House after U.S. President Donald Trump on Friday said that he had decided to ban the popular short video app. That's according to two people familiar with the matter on Saturday. Reuters' Sierra Lee has more.
As relations between the US and China deteriorate, the short video app TikTok has emerged as a flashpoint in the dispute between the world's two largest economies. Now, the Chinese owner of the app, ByteDance, has agreed to divest the US operations of TikTok completely in a bid to save a deal with the White House. The latest developments are according to two people familiar with the matter. It comes after President Trump said on Friday he had decided to ban the popular video app. US officials have said TikTok, under its Chinese parent, poses a national risk because of the personal data it handles. ByteDance's concession would test whether Trump's threat to ban TikTok is a negotiating tactic or whether he's intent on cracking down on the app. TikTok boasts it has 100 million users in the US. ByteDance was previously seeking to keep a minority stake in the US business of TikTok, which the White House has rejected. Under the new proposed deal, sources said ByteDance would exit completely and Microsoft would take over TikTok in the United States. They added that some ByteDance investors that are based in the US may be given the opportunity to take minority stakes in the business. About 70% of ByteDance's outside investors come from the US. ByteDance in Beijing and Microsoft did not respond to a request for comment.
Sierra Lee reports for Reuters News. And finally, Willis Conover. He helped popularize jazz throughout Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. And for 41 years, he hosted the Jazz Hour on The Voice of America, introducing jazz to a worldwide audience. VOA's Michael Sullivan has this look.
Dark days behind the Iron Curtain after the Soviet Union extended its grip as far as East Germany. From Washington, the sounds of another world over the radio.
This is the Voice of America Jazz Hour.
Thelonious Monk and Dizzy Gillespie were among the many jazz greats who appeared on Conover's program, drawing millions of listeners over 41 years.
They came to VOA for the jazz and they stayed for the news.
News they couldn't get in their own countries.
The music of jazz parallels the freedom that we have in America.
something that not every country has.
Jazz as an art form was not just a wonderful thing to listen to, but it was something people could learn from without necessarily realizing they were learning from it.
Conover provided encouragement to Eastern Bloc jazz lovers, and in 1956, during the Hungarian uprising against Soviet domination.
The 1956 program featuring the Hungarian musicians who had secretly sent a tape to Willis Conover.
Here for the world is their living testimonial in the universal language of music.
Conover accompanied State Department jazz tours through Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and Africa.
Van Willis Conover.
A VOA technician who later worked with Conover on his shows spent many hours listening to his stories.
He was so deep into the jazz world, the musicians knew him, they trusted him, which was very important because when he started working at VOA, some musicians would say that he sold out when he did not at all sell out. In fact, what he did was he opened up the rest of the world, mainly the Eastern Bloc countries, to this music.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.
Conover died in 1996, but left a legacy. He introduced the world to the creative energies of jazz and to the country that gave birth to the music. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a recent speech held in the state of Iowa on religious freedom, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called religious freedom our first freedom according to the Constitution and said a high respect for this unalienable right guides our administration. Religious freedom remains under threat in many countries. Secretary Pompeo pointed out that 4 out of 5 people around the world don't enjoy full religious freedom. In order to improve conditions for people seeking to exercise their freedom of conscience, the United States is using all the tools it has at its disposal, including naming countries that violate this fundamental right.
We've called out China's war on faith, its mass detention of Uyghurs, its godless decisions to replace church displays of the Ten Commandments with words from General Secretary Xi have not gone without being called out.
Over the past 2 years, the State Department has hosted 2 ministerials to advance religious freedom, where nations and religious leaders from around the world gather with the aim of protecting the fundamental right of religious freedom. America is deeply committed to protecting the fundamental freedoms of people around the world. This is a proud legacy of the nation's founders, who built the United States on a commitment to guarantee the American people certain unalienable rights that are laid out in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, said Secretary Pompeo. Our nation's foreign policy must be grounded in that central understanding, declared Secretary Pompeo. That's the commitment that's made us a shining star of liberty in the world. Our house of foreign policy is built on solid rock, on these bedrock principles that were made at our founding.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.